Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is William Giroux. He is the author of the brand new book, The Ghost Ships of Archangel, The Arctic Voyage That Defied the Nazis. The book's available now wherever your fine books are sold. William has written extensively about World War II and most notably the Matthews Men that came out a little bit ago. William, what's a ghost ship?
Well, I sort of dubbed these the ghost ships. These are four ships that, in the course of a convoy going across the Arctic, were separated from the convoy. The convoy actually broke up, and these ships, the ghost ships, tried to escape from the Germans by going north into the polar ice field. The men painted the ships white and spread bed sheets and tablecloths on the decks to camouflage them, so they were all white, and nobody expected to see these ships again. So they sort of, the ghost ship's name was almost inevitable.
Well, it is 1942 when this story takes place, so what's the state of the war at that time? America's fairly new into it, right?
Yes, we were fighting in the Pacific, of course, because the Japanese had really left us no choice. But we did not have any troops on the battlefield against the Germans at that point. This was 6 months after Pearl Harbor, and the British weren't really fighting them in Europe either. And the only armed force between Hitler and the total conquest of Europe was the Soviet Union. So the Nazis and the Soviets were engaged in just a ferocious war on the Eastern Front, but we were pretty much on the sidelines at that point.
And as I read this, and I've got to admit my knowledge of World War II history is not what it should be, but there was an alliance, albeit a tainted alliance, between America and the Soviet Union at the time. Can you explain how that alliance came to be and what the nature of it was?
Yes. One of the chapters is titled The Enemy of My Enemy, and basically the U.S. and the Soviet Union were not really friends, but they found themselves in a position where they were both enemies of the Nazis. So they engaged in a very shaky alliance of convenience to try to defeat the Nazis, and the question for us was how much help should we give the Soviet Union? And there were some people in the United States that did kind of like the idea of seeing the Soviets and the Nazis tearing each other to pieces, but it was certainly in our interest. We clearly thought the Nazis were the greater enemy.
PQ-17 is the name of this ship, and can you kind of explain where that type of a name comes from? I always find that interesting, where these ships are named.
The PQ-17, the convoys that went across the Arctic, each of them were given code names just for the military to use for convenience. And the PQ was actually the initials of a British convoy planner, and the 17 was the sequence. It was the 17th of these convoys that were going across the Arctic. So it was, therefore, it was PQ, this guy's initials, and 17, the first of the PQ convoys was PQ-1, et cetera, et cetera.
Not quite as romantic as the SS Jenny and Forrest Gump or anything like that, but,
no.
This story, you pull it out of here and out of World War II, it seems like everything that can be written about World War II has been written, and yet I'm always amazed. Every time an author comes out with a new book, it's another story that I haven't heard of. So when you discovered this story, was it a thing about, was it just going down a rabbit hole and trying to research this little piece of history that you found?
I actually came across this story when I was researching the Matthews Men, because there's a chapter in that book about these Arctic convoys, and when I got to PQ-17, I started reading about it, and I thought, wow, this is fascinating. But there weren't any, I couldn't use it in the first book. And I kept wanting to read it, and I finally thought, okay, I need to finish this book I'm working on, so I'll set this aside and maybe pick it up later. And when I finished, that's how it came about. This book is the result of that. I had set a bunch of material aside thinking I might get to it another time, and I have.
The subtitle describes it as an Arctic voyage. So where geographically are we talking? We up where Santa Claus lives?
Well, we're these convoys that went across the Arctic, a lot of them left from Iceland, and they sailed east and southeast to either Murmansk or Archangel, the two great North Russia ports. And they would generally sail along the edge of the polar ice field extending down from the North Pole. So they're probably, 700 or 800 miles from the North Pole, and they would have gotten closer, but the ice prevented them from getting any closer.
What all were they hauling?
They were hauling just about everything you could imagine. Planes, tanks, trucks, communication equipment, electronics, raw steel to get the Soviet factories going again. A lot of it was food because the Soviet Union in many areas was starving. And so a lot of these convoys, they're thought of as, hauling weapons of war, which they certainly did, but a great deal of what they hauled was food to try to keep the Soviet populace alive, because things were very desperate over there at the time these convoys sailed.
How old were the soldiers who were part of this convoy?
They, some of them were just as green as they could be. One of the main characters is 21 years old. He'd never been on a ship before, never been in war before. But some of them were veteran guys who had been sailing ships for years and years and years. And although some of those veteran guys avoided the Arctic voyages like the plague, because they were so dangerous and miserable, even in peacetime. So you had quite a mix age-wise from the men on these ships.
When you mentioned the youngness of it, Howard Carraway, a kid from South Carolina, and very green at this. There were other people. The personal stories that you tell in here about William Carter, he turned down Harvard Business School, of all things, to get into the Navy. What is their attitude like as they're going on this convoy, thinking, I could have had such a better life if I would have just pursued my chosen career path versus this mission that we're now on?
I think when they started out, they were guys like that were just, they were gung-ho. They were young guys. They were angry after Pearl Harbor. They wanted to strike a blow, and they thought, okay, we're going to get out there. But once they got involved in the convoy and realized what a sketchy operation it was. It was very much, catch as catch can, a sort of an ad hoc thing with old ships that weren't particularly well defended. I think as the thing went on for Carter and Carraway and some of the others, they began thinking, what have we gotten ourselves into? We thought this was going to be a lot better organized and executed than it is.
Just the whole idea of being in the Arctic for a combat scene dredges up these ideas of icebergs and coldness. So, what's the weather like as they're up there?
Well, in the winter, the Arctic can be a very ferocious place with great, huge, steep seas and temperatures 30, 40 below, hurricane force winds. But in the summer, when PQ-17 sailed, the Arctic is a very different place. It's, there's not a lot of storms, and many days the ocean is as flat as a duck pond under a brilliant sun, and with great billowing masses of fog going around. So it's a really different place, but the Arctic is even more dangerous for convoys in the summer than in the winter, because in the summer, for much of the summer, the sun in the Arctic never sets because of the tilt of the Earth's axis. So these convoys are sailing in perpetual 24-hour daylight and therefore subject to literally constant attacks by the Germans. They have there's no darkness where they can hide or even get a break from the attacks. They're just out there, constantly exposed.
This story, I've never heard of it before, and so, until your book. But why are stories like this? They seem to be more well known overseas in Great Britain or Russia than they are here. Why would that be?
This story is much better known both in Great Britain and Russia. In Great Britain, PQ-17 was something of a scandal because the Royal Navy, the British Royal Navy, was in charge of protecting the convoys, and the government, after this happened, was less than candid with the public about what had happened to PQ-17. In Russia, these convoys are very much a part of the Russian narrative of the war. They were Russian ships were serving in these, and this was the supply line from Russia. And there are different views in Russia about how much these convoys actually helped. But they are, you know, Russian children learn about these convoys in school. There have been books written. There was recently a TV miniseries about PQ-17 in Russia. So it's in Russia, people are much more aware of this. And we have sort of forgotten about it, I think, because it was a time for us where we weren't really, you know, we weren't over there fighting. There weren't big battles taking place. So we don't, you know, we tend to focus on those. And this was a sort of a strange period where we were kind of inactive in at least in Europe.
There's a photograph on the front cover of the book. It has five young men aboard a ship, and the photograph dredges up images for me of the Hickory High School boys from the movie Hoosiers. Where did this photograph come from?
You know, it's a it's just a stock photo that the publishers found. These are not these guys aren't from PQ-17, but I think they're, you know, looking at it, I liked the photo because they're there isn't a comparable real photo of a PQ-17, and these guys to me just looked like, you know, they, as you say, they just look like typical American guys who were, you know, setting out on this mission, I guess, with high hopes and maybe a hint of worry in their faces. And I think it's a really good depiction of what, you know, the kind of people that were on this convoy and the sort of mood that they were in when they set out. I think the picture kind of shows a convoy setting out, perhaps from Iceland.
We obviously didn't have the Situation Room capabilities back then like we do today at the White House. So what was FDR's role and oversight of all this, or was this completely left up to the generals on the ground and those in charge of the military?
At the time when this happened, in the summer of 42, America and Britain were, you know, of course, close allies, but it had become clear that America was going to be, you know, was almost the senior partner in this at this point. The British were exhausted, and America was just entering the war. We had all this power, so in a way, FDR, Franklin D. Roosevelt, was sort of the big boss, but he sort of left particulars to the British, because the British were protecting the convoys. But one thing FDR did is said, these things have got to keep sailing, no matter what. Even if it's summer, even if they're going to get savaged by the Germans, they were almost it was a political decision to keep Joseph Stalin, the dictator of Russia, happy, because we weren't really helping him at that point in any other way except sending him supplies. And if Roosevelt was afraid if we stopped doing that Stalin might turn around and bail out of the alliance with America and Britain and rejoin Hitler.
I thought it was interesting. About two-thirds of the way through the book, you have a scene. It's in January of 43. President Roosevelt visits the troops in, I believe it was North Africa, and he's the first president to visit U.S. troops in a combat zone since Abraham Lincoln. What was that like for him? What made him decide to go there?
Well, he wanted very much to meet with Stalin, for one thing. He was Roosevelt was already looking forward to a time after the war when he could already see that after the war, America and the Soviet Union were going to be basically the two great powers. And Roosevelt believed that, you know, Roosevelt was, he was so charming and he was so good at working with people that he felt that if he and Stalin could establish some sort of working relationship, that it would make post-war life in Europe much easier and would avoid a lot of the problems that were already looming. And of course, that it didn't it didn't work out that way at all. But and some people say it's because Roosevelt died before the end of the war. But I think what it was is people tended to mistake Stalin for a reasonable man that they could work with, and Stalin was not a reasonable man. So,
as you research this book, what sources were available to you through government documents, or was this something that was tougher to find government document-wise?
Well, there's a lot of government. You know, I spent a lot of time in the National Archives, both about ours and the British ones in London, and there's a lot of documents in there. There are also a lot of online and elsewhere, a lot of written accounts by people of PQ-17 that are have been out for a while, and I was able to discover some more that hadn't really been written about. And one in particular, I found a diary of PQ-17 that was 300 and some handwritten pages by a guy who was on one of the ghost ships, and it's just, I think it's the most complete chronicle of PQ-17 that there is. Just a marvelous document. So you're sort of piecing together official documents and accounts, and I found a guy, I think the last living American survivor of PQ-17, an interview went out to Santa Barbara and interviewed him, and he was a feisty, tough, feisty guy at the age of 95.
I'd be willing to bet a diary written by a 20-something back then is a lot more eloquent than would be written by a 20-something these days, with a lot of LOLs and F-bombs, right?
I agree with you. And this, I was fortunate in that this guy, the diarist, was a writer. He was a newspaper columnist, so he had a gift for words and an eye for detail. So it was a diary, but it was there was some really good stuff in that diary, not only that he noticed, but the way he worded things. So there's a lot of that diary in this book.
All right, the book is The Ghost Ships of Archangel, The Arctic Voyage That Defied the Nazis. The book's available now wherever your fine books are sold from William Giroux. William, just a fantastic look into a story from World War II that I don't think anybody listening to this probably knows anything about until now. So go pick up the book. You'll really enjoy it. William, thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
Thanks very much for having me.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakulskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time. Where to share?